Good evening, everyone. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and I love meeting paradigm shifters, people who are making a difference in the collective of our species at this time on the planet. And as we were just talking, I was just talking to tonight's paradigm shifter. I was going to call you Robert, but your name is Donald Altman.
Right.
My partner is Donald Robert, so there you have it.
Oh.
Anyway, Donald Altman has a wonderful new book, the fourth in a series, I think. And this is called The Mindfulness Code. And as far as making a difference on the planet, I think most of us know, listening to Paradigm Shifters, that how we use our mind makes a huge difference in how life goes, doesn't it? So welcome to the show, Mr. Altman, Donald Altman.
Oh, well, thank you, Veronica.
Now, you've had quite a history, haven't you, being a Buddhist? You were actually a Buddhist monk?
Yes, that's right. In the Theravada tradition, which is the old school of Buddhism, and I was with a number of Burmese monks in this country, in the U.S., and I really had... It really shifted. Talk about a paradigm shift. It was a real shift in my life.
Mm-hmm. What, like how? Did you go in from being a student, a young man, or what did you go in as?
Yeah, I went into my mid-40s, which I heartily recommend.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I went in at a time that was where my life was really kind of being turned upside down. I always had a spiritual path, but what happened was I met this wonderful man. He was a Burmese monk in his 70s named U Thiyonanda. He'd come to this country many years before, but he was a very well-known teaching monk. In fact, wrote a book called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to learn directly from U Thiyonanda. When I had met him, I was really struck by the sense of compassion and availability that he had just to be there for anybody who needed him. And that really touched me. And I wondered, how does somebody become like that? I really hadn't met anybody in our Western culture like that.
What kind of work were you doing at the time? Were you counseling or teaching?
Well, no, at the time I met him, I was actually, I was either writing, because I had a writing career before I became a psychotherapist, and before I went into the monastery, I was also, it was the first internet comic book online. It was on America Online. It was called Zombie Detective.
Wow.
And I thought I was like a zombie.
Really?
And that experience left me really soul-searching, believe it or not, and wanting to go more deeply into finding my spiritual center.
Wow. So it was a bit of a departure from what we would consider, in quotes, quasi-normal life, right?
Right. And so I ordained with Uthilananda as the teacher, as the main monk. And so I was able to be interviewed with him and start to learn what it was that made him who he was. And what I discovered was that it was the loving kindness practice, that he loved to teach and that I also love to teach and I share. And it's in my book, The Mindfulness Code.
Yeah, I was reading about the loving kindness practice, and it's so empowering, isn't it?
It really is. And what's amazing is, you know, if you look back at the history of it, it developed because at the time, the 2,500 years ago, the Buddha told the monks to go out into the jungle and meditate, and they came back and they said, "Oh, you know, we don't like it there. There are scary things out there." So you know, they had a lot of fear. And Buddha said, "Well, let me give you a meditation and some words that will help you overcome this fear and this mistrust that you have." And believe it or not, 2,500 years later, the loving kindness meditation is being used by therapists to help people with trauma and to actually help people. It's called a security priming, words that actually calm the inner core, the limbic system, part of the brain that is very reactive. And they've discovered that people that are traumatized, even at young ages, that part of the brain can kind of turn the volume up. And these words, probably the earliest, what's called a security priming by scientists today, because it primes the inner core of the brain for a sense of peace and trust.
Oh, my. So people who are traumatized as small people have a harder time establishing that, right?
Yes, that's right.
But in the loving kindness meditation, can you share some of those words with us? I could use a little calming tonight.
I think we've all had our share of trauma being on this blue planet. And so we could use these words. And so the words that I like to give people are very, very simple. And I adapted the loving kindness practice. And so here's how I say it. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. Again, may I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. Now, I repeat these words for myself throughout the day. I'm not shy about telling people this because there are things happening that are always ready to throw us off center, and we need to be finding that calm, finding that center, opening up, because this does help you feel safer. I've used these words for people who actually every day felt this sense of dread. Imagine walking around with this heaviness and this dread and this feeling that you really couldn't open up to the universe or open up to the possibility of what's going to happen next.
And I think a lot of that is resonant in the collective these days, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way to counterbalance that. We need to be able to find ways to come back to center, and these words can do that for you. So
Do it one more time, will you, please?
Yeah. And so I want people to remember these, write them down, and just say them for yourself throughout the day. And you can think of this as coming from any source, whatever. If you're connected to to God or the divine, you could imagine it coming from that source. You could imagine it just being a blessing or a wish, or you could imagine it coming from others who have loved you. So however you envision it, here are the words again. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. Again, may I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And you may want to also find other words. May I be loved. May I be accepted. May I find compassion. Whatever you find might spontaneously arise as your need, as your special words, you can add those to these.
And I think that it does change your brain, doesn't it? It actually gets right into the inner parts of the brain and changes it, softens it, doesn't it?
It does. And one of the things that I've done in the Mindfulness Code that I think makes it different from some other books is I bring in a lot of different research, brain-related research and other information in here. And it's a very exciting time to be alive because we're finding out, mystics and others have known that these things have worked, but now we're actually starting to understand why they work. Mm-hmm. And so these things really do change the brain at a very profound level. In fact, they've been used, these security primings have been tested on many different groups, even Palestinians and Israelis.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, and they found that once they were exposed to these words, they were more open and able to see the other group with a greater sense of openness and trust.
Well, it's interesting because you were talking about your comic book and the zombie part of it, and then you said you really were, what did you say, you were really numb or something?
Yeah, I became like a walking zombie myself. Experience.
But then I'm chuckling all the way through this because what you're saying is that inner quiet, the difference between the numbness and that inner quiet is what you're saying is a conscious direction that goes through and evokes an awakening in your mind, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's wonderful.
That's a nice way of putting it, Veronica, because if we get numbed out or not really present and we're more likely to want to medicate ourselves in some way, whereas if we're able to apply mindfulness, apply awareness to what's ever happening, we don't have to run from it. We don't have to try to escape this moment. A lot of times we're trying to, maybe we're not even consciously, but there's maybe an unconscious rejection of what's happening to us right now. And this brings up, this reminds me of a quote, and I have this in, it's actually in the first chapter.
You have the most wonderful quotes in this book, I have to say.
Oh,
I was going to mark them.
Well, thanks a lot. I tried to find quotes that maybe a lot of people hadn't heard of. But I like this one from Charles Tart, and this is in a chapter called Accept This Moment. It's the first chapter because I think it really is an important teaching. And I see each of these chapters as a teaching, as it's kind of a mini self-enclosed teaching on how to be more present, how to be more mindful and intentional in your life. So the quote from Charles Tart is, "The trouble with ordinary reality is that a lot of it is dull, so we long ago decided to leave for somewhere better." And we've all probably left for somewhere. But what I think is that maybe it's not that reality is dull, but that we could just sharpen our awareness.
Well, yeah, it's interesting how you take us in this book, which I'm pretty interested in. It's very fascinating because I work with a lot of people and in their well-being and so on. And you've broken it into four sections that you can enter the depth of understanding and that centering and the mindfulness through the mind, through the body, through the spirit, and through the relationship. I like that a lot.
Oh, thanks. Because these are all interrelated, and it's important to be able to have the mind key, and I call them keys because they unlock our awareness and let us get into the present moment. And the mind key is important. It actually allows us to start to really decipher how our mind works, and to understand mind at a very profound level.
Well, I liked your story about the eating disorder clinic. Because that was such a, I don't know whether that worked over a long period of time, and you might want to recap that for people.
Yeah, let me share that because that's a wonderful example of the mind key and the way in which people could change their brain from the inside out. Well, I worked I was the mindfulness guy, I should say, at an eating disorder clinic. And I worked there for 3.5 years. And one day I was leading a group, and I went in, and I could tell the group was really struggling. And there were about maybe 12, 13 girls in that group. And I said, "So what's the problem here today? It seems like you're having a hard time focusing." And they said, "Donald, we are stuck in our eating disorder thoughts, and we can't seem to get out." So I said, "Okay, let's try something different here today. I want everybody to stand up. We're going to explore the room. Well, this caused a little bit of an uproar because many of these people, they'd been in that room for since, like, you know, you get there at 7:30 in the morning, they'd have their meals, and they'd come back to the group room, and they'd be there until maybe 6 at night, and for 2 to 3 months, and they said, well, why do we need to do this? We know this room like the back of our hand. And I said, well, you think you know the room, but let's just give this a shot. Just be open, and let's just try it. And so they said, oh, okay, we'll try it. And so they stood up, and I guided them around the room. But what I did was I had them really notice the finest, smallest details, the little grains on the table where they worked, the little wood grains and how they moved and were separated, and the colors of those, what the walls looked like, even all the little bumps on the walls and the cracks, and how the paint was faded a little bit from where the sun came in, and how the ceiling looked, and where the vents were, and what did the vents sound like when the heating turned on. So all these little things, even walking, how did it feel as their foot moved in their shoe as they stepped slowly onto the concrete floor. And so we did this, and I had them sit down, and I said, so we were doing that for 15 minutes, and their jaws dropped. I didn't believe it. And then I said, so tell me, where were your eating disorder thoughts? And there was just a look of, really, of like, aha moments on some of these faces that I'll never forget. And one girl just raised her hand, and she said, oh, my God, it seemed like I actually left the fantasy world of my thoughts for reality for those few minutes. And another girl raised her hand and said, yeah, me too. And I realized I don't like my fantasies getting interrupted.
Wow.
She was happy to stay there, but she came out. And this was a victory. You have to understand that for this population where it's this is the highest mortality rate with anorexia and bulimia in the mental health field. And
is that especially with girls, or is that just all through?
Mostly with females in that. I think 9 out of 10 are females who struggle with that. Although more men and boys are showing up. But and the thing is that they get so stuck in those thoughts that it can steal away their lives. And so for them,
aren't they stuck in the impossibility of the situation? Like they can't get over it. Isn't that the stuck part?
Yeah, they're stuck in that, and they're stuck in this fantasy world of
how thin they are.
Yeah, how thin they are. They're not thin enough. All the self-talk that's going on in their mind, and they can't really see the world that's out there. It's like they're wearing this pair of dark glasses, and it's blocking the sunlight from coming in. And so for them to even see the light for that brief little time was a victory for them. It lets them see that there is another way, that those thoughts maybe aren't all they're cracked up to be, that they're not maybe as solid and substantial as they think they are.
It's not who they are, is it?
Right, that those thoughts are not who they are. They're not defined by those thoughts. This is a very powerful thing for anybody, actually, to realize, because we're very left-brain culture, right? And so we can get very wrapped up in our thoughts and our planning and our thinking, and sometimes we can start to confuse that for who we are.
And those traps. What about PTSD? You have a little section here on PTSD. Can you, like, you're a psychotherapist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you use this through many different styles of helping people?
Oh, absolutely. And for PTSD, one of the things that there are actually more than one different kind of strategy that I have in the book. I tried to provide simple and practical techniques people could really use for anxiety, depression, and even PTSD. The loving kindness practice we did would be helpful for PTSD. And I actually have also something which is it's called the body scan in the book. And this is a way of actually being aware of each part of the body moment to moment. And what it actually does is it helps people get grounded, get out of the world of thoughts for a moment, and get grounded in the body, which is very much in the present moment. and it can be useful for PTSD. What I also tell people is that there are sometimes when, if you're going through one of these exercises here, that if you feel you need, that it gets too scary, you're always in control. And if people need to get other help, then go get that help. You know, sometimes our body is telling us that we need to listen to the wisdom of our body, and if something feels too scary, then maybe we need to get other resources to help us too. So that's also in the book. I mean, I think it's important for us to check into the body. If you're thinking about making decisions and you only use your brain and you never check in with the body, it's very difficult. We need the body to get into the present moment. Let me give you an example of it. Let's do a little something right now that I think could help. Even
an exercise? I'd like that.
Yeah, this is an exercise. Okay. And this is also good for PTSD.
Okay.
Because if you're in the moment where you're actually having a flashback or feeling that you're not here or dissociated in any way, I call this palming the present moment. We're going to literally use our palms to grab the present moment. So what I want you to do, make sure if you're driving, you don't want to do this. Just remember it and do it later. So what I want everybody to do is to slowly bring your palms and your hands together in front of you until your fingertips are just touching. This only takes about 30 seconds. Now slowly bring your palms together. Notice as the heat is building up. When does the heat start? And finally your palms start to touch. Now press a little harder, and now bring your elbows out to the side and press harder, noticing how far the tension goes up your arm. Does it go from the wrist? Does it go into the elbow? Does it go up to the shoulder? Does it even go up into the back or behind the shoulder blades as you're pressing? Now on the count of 3, 2, 1, slowly release. Let your palms come about an inch or two apart, fingertips still touching. Notice how the coolness is coming off the palms now, and the heat is releasing. Feel what it's like to have released the tension in the elbows and the wrists of your hand. And there you go. I mean, for that 30, 40 seconds, were you thinking about the past? Were you focused on the future? And I hope you were really paying attention to what was happening right there. And if you were, then you were palming the present moment. And
I love that, and actually feeling the energy up through the back when you spoke of the back.
Oh, good.
It was a really feeling conscious of the way the body holds things, and it seemed to release itself, actually.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, yeah, actually, so we have this ability, and it's a way of coming back to our senses when you think about it, our sense ability. And we're wired for this kind of mindful awareness through the body, and that's what that's one of the exercises actually in the body key. And the power of the body, or the power of breath, is that you can't take a breath for yesterday or tomorrow. I hope not, anyway. You take the breath for right now, and we're really embodied in this moment.
But we often do hold our breath in a state of turmoil, don't we? We often,
absolutely,
when we're frightened and so on. So you recommend that people, what are you talking about, a diaphragmatic breath in here, I believe.
Yeah, I talk about a diaphragmatic breath or a belly breath.
How does that work? Can you demonstrate
that too. Let me first say that when you do this, I call this really the air conditioning system of the body and the brain, because you are literally changing how your body is reacting to stress. If you're under stress, and that can be from a job, it can be when you're on the freeway, it can be an argument that you get in with somebody, and it can be from not getting enough sleep for 3 days in a row. So how many people have that problem? What happens then is you have these stress hormones going through your body and through your brain, and cortisol in particular, which goes through the body and the brain, if it's in the body for a long time, it puts the brakes on your immune system. And I mean, it literally, we're talking about changing at the cellular level. I mean, you're cutting down the number of T cells that you have, NK cells, which are natural killer cells. They fight viruses and tumors. And also cortisol, as it floods the brain, can affect your ability to learn. It actually kills neurons in the hippocampus, which is the learning center of the brain, and can even make memory retrieval difficult. People who are depressed, for example, their hippocampus shrinks. So here we are.
So you're saying your emotional state has a physiological effect. Well, we kind of know that, but it's good to hear evidence of that.
Yeah, but we need to understand the physiology, which we often don't understand. And even I even talk in the book about this Nobel Prize-winning scientist, Elizabeth Blackburn, who discovered that telomeres, she actually discovered the telomeres. These are little like shoelaces at the end of the DNA that kind of hold the DNA together, and when they thin or die, and the cell dies, and we start to age as these naturally as these thin. But Blackburn discovered that, and another and a psychologist, Alyssa Eppel, together, they discovered for the first time that stress thins the telomeres years before their time, as much as 10 years of extra aging, and that's in the blood cells of the blood. So,
and what can we do? Can we restore? Can we refresh that?
Well,
press the refresh button.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's the refresh breath. And what you can do though is you can calm down the body's response to stress, and you can do it through breathing. And so, breathing is really easy to do. You're not going to believe how easy it is, because sometimes what happens is people learn methods that are too complicated. Breathe in, hold it for 5 beats, breathe out through your nose, whatever. This is not like that at all. We're going to do one simple movement, and that is going to alter how you breathe, and that is simply to move your arms behind your back and clasp your hands together. And now what are you doing? You are actually stretching open the lungs. There are muscles that go through the lungs called the intercostals. You're stretching them, and you're hinging the ribs open. And the breath is coming further down, pressing on the lungs are pressing on the diaphragmatic wall. And you'll notice your abdomen rising and falling. Okay? And so,
I have to move the microphone, or I'll be breathing into it.
The other thing is for women, and Veronica, tell me if you found this to be true. A lot of women are often kind of, told, hold your stomach in.
Oh, yes. Supposed to have a flat belly, right?
Flat belly. And so if you do that, though, you can't do this breathing. You need to let the stomach muscles loose, let them relax.
This is why we like radio, Donald.
That's great. And it's also why anybody could do this if you're, in private if you want, or wherever you feel comfortable. So with the arms back there, if you've been doing this even for 30 seconds while Veronica and I have been talking, you are actually lowering your blood pressure, lowering your pulse rate, respiration rate, increasing alpha brain waves. It's the calm and alert kind of brain waves. And in addition, believe it or not, you're releasing serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, into the bloodstream. 95% of serotonin is stored in the gut. And when you breathe in this way, it's released. It gets into the bloodstream. It's stored in the stomach lining. That's a neurotransmitter, I'm sure, as Veronica knows, that is like it helps moderate, helps produce good mood, helps you feel good.
But you don't have to do any kind of like really loud breathing or anything. We just allow the pulse.
If you take too deep a breath, you can get lightheaded, so don't do that. This is just a normal breath. Imagine that you're pouring water into a cup. Even if you pour a little bit of water into the cup, it goes into the bottom of the cup. And that's the idea here, that even a little breath can go into the bottom of the lungs and move the abdomen out.
It feels really good. And like I told you, I talked to several people in intense turmoil just before I started the show, and I'm feeling calmer and calmer. Something's working. The other thing I remember reading in the book is that when you feel stressed and you're really, we think we have to do so many things and how are we going to get it all done? And then we get really tense and we're running this kind of ball of thought through our heads and so on. And didn't you say in the book that our inspiration will come more easily when you do this kind of thing?
I think it will. I think that what we need to do is to learn how to do one thing and participate in it with 100% of our awareness and allow ourselves to really be in this moment and not to push it away. So you could do, I have a chapter called Do One Thing Joyfully Right Now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, believe it or not, it's kind of a funny story I want to share with you. Is somebody had read this chapter, and I guess it got around their office, and so people started skipping, like you know, how you would skip as a kid.
Hippity hop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, skippity hopping around the office, and then everybody started to do this. They were just doing their one joyful hopping and skipping.
How great. and having fun while they're at it.
And having fun while they're at it. So I think the other point that you're saying is that sometimes we push ourselves too hard, and we start to think of ourselves as machines. And this is doing ourselves an injustice. I actually talk about a little about the history of that. If you go back to 1911, there was a man by the name of, this is kind of interesting, a man by the name of Frederick Taylor. And he was an American mechanical engineer, and he wrote a paper called called Scientific Management or Scientific Time Management. And he changed the way people worked. He's the guy that brought the stopwatch into the workplace. And so what happened was, at the time, and this was in the early 1900s, there were riots. People didn't want to just be made into machines. And he didn't want workers to think at all. And Congress even investigated him, and there were charges of Taylorism. And but we know what happened.
I said, oh, my.
Yeah, we know what happened, though, was that this idea that we had to be more productive and efficient won out. Frederick Taylor, if you look in books on MBAs right now, he's kind of revered as the guy that did all this. But what happens when we try to make ourselves into machines and we take away our humanity, when we eat at lunchtime while we're still working on the computer, we don't give ourselves the space to really connect with nature and the natural world and food and how it can nourish us, what happens is we start feeling a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress. And I've had people come to me, and I'm sure you've had this, where their workplace and the demands on them were so great that they started to have panic attacks or anxiety attacks and couldn't function. One guy who came to me had actually worked in a warehouse, and he had a contraption on his arm that actually kept track of where he was moment by moment.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was a GPS locator.
Oh, my.
It also would pop up. It would pop up with, and it would time him every, for every job that he was doing, it would actually start, like, and start timing him.
Oh,
and
Lord.
When he would move things from one part of the warehouse to another, it would come up with his total time.
Is that so he could be more efficient?
Yeah. And
oh,
whether
my.
It was too fast or too slow, it would pop up the next job. And he couldn't take it after a while. And he didn't want to leave the job, but he had to, because this job was not a good fit for him being a human being, actually. And so we have to think about, while we do work in systems, and all of us are connected to some system, how do we maintain our humanity? How do we maintain our sense of presence in this moment?
Well, there's
moment?
A section where you're talking about asking yourself if you're actually in what? In cahoots, in sync, in harmony with your own purpose as well, right?
Mm. Purpose is really important, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's actually the spirit, part of the spirit key that I talk about in the book, and how can we use meaning and purpose to help us. And even if, let's say you're in a job that maybe isn't the ideal job, you could still connect to your purpose and what that job is providing for you in a positive way, even while you're looking for that new job that might be better. So we need to find purpose. We need to find reasons for doing things that are important.
Yeah, that still requires engaging with that inner flow and that.
That's right.
Well, this is a wonderful book. It really, I'm in the section about power and peace of intention as well. I like the way you've broken it into these different aspects of who we all are as well.
We're multiple dimensional beings, and what I wanted to do was to provide ways for people to tap into that deeper sense of self. And intention is really important. I also, at the beginning of the book, I talk about the four, what I call the real catalyzing active elements of mindful awareness, which are intentionally centering attention now, which is an acronym for I can.
Oh, intentionally centering attention now. Aha.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and what's important for that is that the intention, as you say, that's kind of the driver of our purpose and of our effort to do things intentionally means that maybe fewer accidents are going to happen because we're really aware of the consequences, we're being more present. How could you even, for example, I like to, one exercise I have in the book is to have people spend 5 minutes of intentional living each day. Really being, connecting the mind and the body. Okay, I'm present, I'm standing, I'm doing that one thing with full presence. I'm walking, moving about, and being with the walking, noticing the movement as you're walking. And when you do that, it's very powerful, actually. And there's a funny little story that I tell in the book about a lady who goes to this mindfulness institute, and she wants to understand what it's all about. She takes notes all day, and she's writing things down. And finally, at the end of the day, she says, I want to see the headmaster. And the headmaster comes over and says, what can I do for you? And she says, you know, I've been watching you people at this mindfulness center all day, and I do the same things at home. I just don't see what you're doing. When I walk, I see you walk. I see you have a meal. I eat my meals. You sit, I sit. And she says, so I don't really understand what the big deal is. And the guy says, well, the difference is that when we walk, we walk. When we sit, full presence. When we eat, we're really present with every little movement, with the chewing, with the tasting. We're really experiencing it 100%. And just then her telephone rings, and she answers her phone, and the guy says, oh, by the way, we don't multitask.
That's funny. Well, I want to jump back and you becoming a monk. Was there a huge transition for you? Did you have to go through some retraining or some, you know, big adjustments at all?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I did. When I first ordained, I did have issues with food and moderating my food intake. I was a very emotional eater. And so before I went in, I knew that the monks would get up at 3:30 in the morning. They'd have a short breakfast from 6:30 to 7, and then another, then lunch from 11 to 12, and they wouldn't eat after that. And that scared the heck out of me to think that I... And so right before I went in, I went to one of my favorite restaurants and had this huge meal on the day I was going to ordain. And then I went in, and the first thing they do, of course, is when they're cutting up, they have a straight razor, and they're shaving my head, and I had more hair back then. For anybody who goes to my website, you'll notice that I don't have a whole lot now. But so
it's very popular these days.
Yeah, it is. And so they held my hair in front of me, and they said, this is not you. And even that first lesson starts to kind of understand, well, who is this? What is this identity, right? Just starting to look deeper. And so I went in, went through the whole ceremony. It was a beautiful ceremony. It lasted about 3 hours out in this field, and the sun was setting. This golden color was just immersing everything. And I walked, was given an alms bowl, and that's all I had now, and people put in some things in there. And then I went to this, myself and two new monks went to a little room, and we sat down in this room, and I just took one of the three futons and didn't think about it. And as I'm sitting there, for the first time it really hit me, I'm in these saffron robes, and they shaved off all my hair, and I'm just feeling very, very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it just hits me, oh my goodness, what have I really did this. What do I do now? And I really, you know, this is as an emotional eater, what I really would love to have some food to make me distract or make me just feel better temporarily. And I turned to my left, something draws my attention, and here's a little shelving unit. About 18 inches from my nose is this giant Cadbury's chocolate bar. In that moment, my first thought, I'll never forget it, was somebody set me up. Well, I had spent a lifetime setting myself up. That didn't occur to me right then. But I really wanted that chocolate bar. And yet, at the other hand, I had just taken a vow not to eat after 12 noon. So here was this war that was going on, and I think everybody can relate to the different times and different areas in our lives where we've had some kind of war going on in our mind.
Oh, you betcha.
Only this time, I couldn't escape it. I had to sit there.
You contracted it, yes.
And then something interesting happened after, I don't know, it was after a long time, and I thought about taking the chocolate bar because one monk was sleeping and the other one was doing his beads, and I thought I could get the bar, but I took this vow if not to eat after 12 noon. And then I got my first lesson in mindful awareness, which was suddenly, instead of being that voice in that wounded emotional voice that really needed this chocolate bar, I was just watching the voice. And it kind of shocked me at first just to be separated from it. I didn't realize at the time that there was a part of my brain that is this attentional awareness that can just observe in a neutral, non-judging way just to watch the show. It's like you're watching in the movie theater. Instead of one minute you're feeling that, you know, you're connected with the movie and it feels like you're all wrapped up in it. The next minute it's like the lights turn on. It's like, oh, it's just a movie. Wait, why am I crying? And so here it was. Suddenly the lights went on. And I call this the inner, it's like an inner light that can shine on her other awarenesses.
That's wonderful. So you didn't need the whack over the head with the...
No.
You always hear that about some of the meditation masters, right?
Right. They didn't do that in our monastery, which was good, I think.
So how long were you there? I mean, I'm very interested in your process there.
Yeah, well, I was there for 4 months, so I wasn't there for a long time. But what I was going to mention was that I think I was very right, because after I got past that initial shock, I really took to it in a way that even amazed me. I mean, that I was really able to meditate for many hours a day.
Hmm.
And, I mean, I had meditated a little bit before, but never like this. But somehow there was a huge shift that occurred in me. And people who knew me would say I came out a different person. I think I was just very ripe.
But don't you think also that the collective, even in this small collective, has such a powerful impact as well? I mean,
it was a combination of the monks who were there. You're absolutely right. I think that because Uthilananda was there, mm-hmm. there was another monk there who was a very amazing monk, and I'm still very close friends with him. We call ourselves monk brothers.
Aww.
We're spiritual brothers, and he was there, and so I think you're absolutely right, and I think the energy of the monks and of that collective really probably helped make the shift also.
So why did you leave in 4 months? Were you done, or did you?
I went in. I mean, and some people don't understand. In different traditions, you actually can go in for a period of time.
Oh, okay.
And this is not uncommon in the Theravada tradition, that people go in for periods of time. In fact, there are many people who, in that tradition, in the Theravada tradition, is in Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos. And so in those countries, it's not uncommon for people, as they even get older, and maybe let's say they've taken care of their responsibilities in life, and they've raised their kids, and maybe their spouse is taken care of now, and everything's okay, that they will go into the monastery to end their lives there. For years, just as they've aged to the point where they can, like I say, their responsibilities are taken care of. Other people go in for different periods of time. And I knew one gentleman who'd gone in 15 different times to be a monk.
Hmm.
So it's a way, and it's really nice because you're able to get that, satisfy that need for that deeper spiritual connection.
So when you came out and you're
still be a lay person.
When you came out and you're back to your psychotherapeutic practice and so on, right?
Well, at the time I wasn't a therapist, but I think it led me there, which is really interesting. It turned my life in a completely different direction, and it changed my purpose. And this is why purpose is so important.
Did you come out to heal the zombies?
My own zombie first.
All of ours, right?
And then we try to help other people to heal their zombies. But when I came out, it was really kind of funny because I was moving in slow motion. And I was still, I still can be very mindful in movement, but I've acclimated more back to the way things are. But I remember shortly after getting out, going to this bookstore, I wanted to get this book on certain mindfulness meditations. And so I went in there and I asked for the book. And just as I had asked for it, the lady just darted off at like a super speed. And she was like a sonic airplane, right? And I'm moving like one of the Wright brothers' planes, so barely getting off the ground, slowly moving through the store, very deliberately. When I'm turning, I'm thinking to myself, turning. I was mindfully walking. So I get there, which seemed like I was just taking my time. And this lady who had rushed off there was still there, but because she was in kind of a frantic mind state, she couldn't locate the book. When I walked up, I just started paying attention, noticing, and I found the title. And I said, oh, this is it. And she had, I mean, it was like the rabbit and the hare, but the, you know, the, or the rabbit and the turtle.
Yeah.
The tortoise, I mean. And so sometimes the tortoise can actually get there faster because they're not so frenetic.
Well, so Donald, that's a good story, actually. Was your, two things, was your monastery, was that in Portland or where was that?
No, the monastery was outside of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still there. It's in it's near the San Bernardino Mountains.
Hmm.
And it's still Burmese monks over there.
And I can't resist this question. So how did you eat when you came out? Did you rush off to your favorite restaurant?
No, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. I'm not saying that I'm never a mindless eater again, but it really changed the way that I ate. I think that's one of the challenges with the eating, of course, and I do have talk about eating a little bit in the mindfulness code too,
mm-hmm.
is that it's something that we do, you know, 10,000 meals every decade, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get very caught in habitual ways of eating. And so what the mindful eating method is, you're actually changing your relationship to food, changing your relationship to how you experience food. And so it did make a big difference. I mean, one day they said to me, this kind of threw me for a loop in the monastery when they said, okay, today you're going to eat your meal opposite Uthilananda, who is this guy that wrote this book on the four foundations of mindfulness.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh no, he's going to just see what a mindless, horrible eater I am. And but I sat opposite him and it was really great. After a little while, I just relaxed and said, no, just stay present with what you're doing. You know, if you're lifting the food up, just be aware that you're lifting it, that the elbow's bending as you're raising the fork to the mouth or whatever, noticing the chew. And I was watching him, and he was just very collected. And I noticed how the other thing that was really nice was that monks aren't just in their own world, but there was a lot of attentiveness to everybody else around the table. So even before you might, or your plate is getting kind of empty, another monk would lift up a bowl of rice and just hand that over to you.
Hmm.
And so there was a real sense of community, even though we ate in silence.
So if you're really centered and you're very mindful, you can actually perceive around you simultaneously, like at the same time, you can spread your attention in a centered way.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the wonderful aspects of mindfulness, and that is the relational part of it, is that you know, also the brain learns through relationship and experience, and that mindfulness, when we bring that into something, when we bring our consciousness into a relationship, whether you're eating with somebody or just in a conversation or connecting with somebody somehow, that it can't help but send ripples where everybody feels this change. And
people feel that your presence is right there with them, right?
Yes, and then what happens is it changes everything. It's like a ripple, two ripples will interact and they'll on water, and they'll create new ripples as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like you're co-creating what's happening, and that mindful awareness is helping that happen. And you're both exploring what's happening together in that moment. I like to think of one way I describe mindfulness is the possibility of awakening and the awakening of possibility.
Aha. That's beautiful. Now, so I'm still pushing you for your story in a way, because you came out of there and then you went to school, went to university to become...
What happened was I came out of the monastery and I started to... wrote a book called Art of the Inner Meal, and I started writing that in the monastery. And I was very grateful for the monks, too, to allow me that space and that place to write that book. I don't think I could have done it otherwise. And then once I finished the book, I started doing retreats and things for people on the spiritual aspects of food and eating. And then people would come up to me and they'd say, oh, I've got this. I'd be very, you know, they'd wait till everybody would leave and they'd come up to me and it was very hushed and they would tell me about some eating disorder problem they had, or I'm restricting food, or I can't, you know, I purge my food. And then I just realized that I needed to get more training if I was going to help those people or work with those people in that way. And so I went back to school and became I got a master's in counseling psychology and then got my license and then worked in an eating disorder clinic for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I still work with that population, but I work with a much broader population now of anybody who's dealing with any kind of stress in their lives. But
how we eat is a perfect, it epitomizes how we're dealing with everything, doesn't it?
It is a wonderful microcosm or a metaphor for how we're dealing with things.
Digesting life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. One time I met this, I was in a Benedictine monastery and I was interviewing one of the brothers there who had also spent time in a Zen monastery. And he baked the bread at this monastery. It was Mount Calvary Monastery in California, and it was a beautiful place, 1,250 feet high, back from the ocean. And I think they called it the Hilton of Monasteries. And so there I was talking with this brother. But then I had, I was spending a little time and looking in the gift shop, and I met this other brother, Brother Alan, and we were talking about this in food and eating, and he was very interested, and he said, I think you can tell a lot about somebody's relationship with God by watching how they eat.
That's
and
right.
It always stuck with me, because I think we can tell a lot about somebody's relationship to life, to stress, by how they eat.
Can you give us, would you be willing to give us all an exercise on eating?
Yeah.
Eating mindfully?
Sure. Okay, let me think what would be a good exercise.
Because I haven't had dinner yet, so I'm going to do that.
Okay. So here is a good exercise if you're going to be having dinner in a little bit, which is when you enter the meal, I want you to notice what your body is feeling. So in other words, your emotions. Mm-hmm. So what a mindful eater does when they enter the meal is they start to notice what their emotions are, because if you're feeling certain emotions, you don't want to be eating those, so to speak, right? You also want to know, what am I hungry for right now?
Hmm.
So that might mean spending a moment doing the breathing like we did a little earlier and just noticing, am I hungry for something crunchy, you know, texture-wise? Am I hungry for something warm or cold? Am I hungry for something that is, you know, a different food group, for example? Is it meat? Is it salad? What is my body really hungry for? And the last part of this is, what is my hunger level? This is really important. I think a lot of times the reasons why diets don't work is that we're given an X amount of food to eat, and we're not really paying attention to what our hunger level is. And so I like to have people rate their hunger on a 1 to 10 scale. So 10 being I'm so hungry, if I don't eat, then I faint or whatever it is, I'm grouchy. People usually know what that is. And a 5, somewhere in the middle, a 1, not hungry at all. And then so you rate it. And and I think the best time to eat a meal is when you're in the 4, 5, 6 range. If you're eating when you're up, get up to the 7, 8, 9, 10. I think the danger there is that you're not. It's going to be much harder to eat mindfully and make the kind of choices that you want to make.
I mean, sticking with what you're really wanting and not just what's there.
Right, not just what's there, or not overeating or eating too quickly, and because what happens is if the hunger is too high and you eat too quickly, you can overeat the amount of food that your body really needs, and it takes about 20 minutes for your blood sugar level to send the signal up to the hypothalamus, that's the appetite center of the brain, to say, I've had enough now.
Mm-hmm.
So you also want to be able to slow your eating down, but it's important to know what your hunger level is. And I want people to think about having a backup plan. Do you have a spare tire in the trunk of your car in case of an emergency?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, do you have food in your car, healthy food, that when you get hungry and you're unable to go get the food you need, just as a backup plan? And so I want people to start thinking about some of these things. So maybe the exercise then would be overall just notice your what's in your body, what emotions you're feeling, and what's your hunger level, and what food would satisfy this hunger.
Hmm.
That would be the exercise.
Wow, I love that. So this book is called The Mindfulness Code, and it's by Donald Altman. It's a wonderful book. It's got a lot of stories, a lot of exercises, and some tremendous quotes. And you also have a website, don't you?
That's right. It's mindfulnesscode.com. And at mindfulnesscode.com, you'll find not just the book, but I have some free downloads because I also created 2 CDs from the book with that have actually 15 of the different meditation, guided meditations
in
the book.
Wonderful.
Including the loving kindness and some other things for PTSD and learning to do this breathing, and I guide everybody through it. And I have 4 of those tracks are free downloads just so you could see what it's like.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Well, maybe we can say goodbye while you lead us out with the loving kindness words.
Oh, great. Well, let's say this for everybody then. May we all be safe. May we all be happy. May we all be healthy. May we all be peaceful. May suffering ones be suffering free. May the fear-struck fearless be. May grieving ones shed all grief. May all beings find relief.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you so much. What a wonderful book that you've written, and I love the service you're giving the world, making a difference. Thank you, Donald Altman.
Oh, thank you. Many blessings, Veronica.
Many blessings to you. Good night.
Good night.
So this is Veronica Entwistle saying the mindfulness code. I'm really enjoying this whole concept of the mindfulness code, the way he presented it. He made it simple, and he really helps us drop right into our center. Good paradigm shifter. This is Veronica Entwistle saying see you on Thursday night, Radiance by Design at 7 o'clock on BBS Radio. We're going to be talking about projections. What are the projections you're putting out there? How do we recognize them coming from other people? How do we neutralize them if that's the goal, which it is for me? And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking with Jackie Salvitti and her team as we do ET healing and explorations in consciousness. Well, good night, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and many, many blessings.
Hey everybody, this is your new friend, Julio.